do you want from me, Coop? You said what you have to say. What else do you want?
You, he says softly. I want you, Quincy.
Contrary to what I've told Sam, I have thought about what could make me succumb to my attraction to Coop. Those blue eyes always struck me as the likely culprit. They're bright as lasers, seeing everything. But it's his voice that finally does it. That soft confession pulling me into his arms. It's our first embrace since Pine Cottage. The first time he's wrapped those strong arms around me. I expect the memory to tarnish this new embrace. It doesn't. It only makes it sweeter. With him, I feel safe. I always have. I kiss him, even though it's wrong. He kisses back, lips hungry, biting. Years of pent-up lust are finally being released, and the result is more need than desire, more pain than pleasure. Soon we're on the bed. There's nowhere else to go. My clothes come off. I don't know how. They seem to simply fall away, as do Coop's. He knows what he wants. God help me. I let him take it.
Pine Cottage, 11:42 p.m. He was still asleep when Quincy slipped from the bed and crossed the room on tiptoe, hunting her shoes, her dress, her panties. It hurt to move. Soreness lingered between her legs, flaring whenever she bent over. Still, it wasn't as bad as she thought it would be. There was consolation in that. She dressed quickly, suddenly aware of the sharp chill hanging in the room. It was as if she had a fever. She shivered from the cold, even though her skin was burning hot. In the hall, Quincy ducked into the bathroom, not bothering to turn on the overhead light. She had no desire to face herself in the mirror under that harsh glare. Instead, she stared at her dark reflection, most of its features erased. She had become a shadow. A chant popped into her head, something from grade school. She and her friends in the pitch-black girls' room, repeating a name. Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary, Quincy said, eyes on her eyeless reflection. Once out of the bathroom, she paused at the entrance to the great room, fearful that Craig and Janelle might have returned, drunk and giggling and pretending like nothing had happened between them. She only proceeded once she heard nothing. The cabin was silent. Quincy headed to the kitchen, standing there, pondering her next step. Should she confront them? Demand to go home? Maybe she'd look for Craig's keys and take his SUV, leaving all of them stranded without their cell phones. The idea made her smile. Already she had entered the second stage of grief, which she learned in psych class only 3 days earlier. Janelle skipped that lecture, and Quincy had yet to give her the notes. She didn't know that second rung in the ladder of grief, but Quincy did. It was anger. Full-throated, bitch-on-wheels anger. Quincy felt it warm in her stomach, like heartburn, only hotter. It pulsed outward, zipping through her arms and legs. She went to the sink, ready to put that fiery energy to use. That was her mom's way. Good old passive-aggressive Sheila Carpenter, cleaning instead of screaming, fixing instead of breaking, never, ever saying what she felt. Quincy didn't want to be that woman. She didn't want to clean up the mess that everyone else had made. She wanted to get mad, damn it. She was mad, so angry that she plucked a dirty plate from the sink and prepared to smash it against the counter. It was her reflection that stopped her, that pale face staring back at her from the window above the kitchen sink. This time she couldn't avoid it. This time she saw herself clearly. eyes red with tears, lips curled into a snarl, skin throbbing pink from anger and heartbreak and shame that she had just given herself to a complete stranger. That wasn't the Quincy she had thought herself to be. It was someone else entirely, someone she didn't recognize. Darkness crept up around her. Quincy sensed it moving in, a black tide washing onto shore. Soon it had surrounded her, shrinking the kitchen, eclipsing it. Quincy could only see her face staring back at her. The stranger's face. Until that, too, was consumed by darkness. Quincy put the plate back in the sink, replacing it in her hand with something else. The knife. She didn't know why she grabbed it. She certainly had no idea what she was going to do with it. All she knew was that it felt good to hold it. With the knife firmly in her grip, she passed through Pine Cottage's back door, crossing the deck in three quick strides. Outside, the trees closest to the cabin stood like gray sentinels guarding the rest of the forest. On her way past, Quincy slapped one with the flat of the blade. The impact shivered into her hand and up her arm as she moved deeper into the woods.
35. A door slams shut, echoing down the hall and jerking me out of a dead sleep. I open my eyes with a gasp, dry air scraping across my tongue. Morning sun burns through the window in a diagonal streak that lands directly on my pillow. Clear and sharp, it feels like needles poking my retinas. I roll over, cursing the sun as I throw my arm across the other side of the bed. It's empty. That's the moment I remember where I am, who I was with, what I've done. I leap from the bed, head dizzy, room spinning. I make it as far as the minuscule bathroom before collapsing to the floor, its tile cold beneath my bare ass, knees drawn to my chest. My thoughts are clouded, indistinct. I feel of this world, but not part of it. It's a hangover, I realize. A guilt hangover. Haven't had one of those in years. Memories creep in at a steady pace, like the tick of a clock secondhand. Tick, tick, tick. Within a minute, it's all come back to me. Every slutty, sordid detail. Coop, obviously, is gone. He could have even been the source of the slamming door, although I suspect he slipped out quietly, preferring not to wake me. I can't say I blame him. At least he was gentlemanly enough to leave a note, hastily scrawled on hotel stationery. I saw it sitting next to the TV as I wobbled to the bathroom. I'll read it later, once I'm able to pick myself up off the floor. My entire body is sore, but in that satisfied way that comes after getting what it wants. It's the way I sometimes feel after jogging, exhausted and sated, and just a little bit worried that I might have overdone it. This time, I have no doubt. I've overdone things in the most cataclysmic way. I look at my hands. Most of the black polish Sam painted on has chipped away, leaving only flecks. There's crud beneath the nails. More polish, most likely. Or maybe flakes of Coop's skin from when I scratched at his back, begging him to fuck me harder. His scent remains on my hands. They smell of sweat, semen, and faintly, Old Spice. I climb to my feet and go to the bowl-sized sink. I splash cold water on my face, careful not to look at myself in the mirror. I'm afraid of what I'll see. Actually, I'm afraid I'll see nothing at all. 2 steps later, I'm at the bed again, sitting down. Coop's note stares at me from its spot beside the TV remote. I grab it and read it. Dear Quincy, I'm ashamed of my behavior. As much as I wanted this to happen, I realize now that it never should have. I think it's best if we don't communicate for a long time. I'm sorry. And that's that. 10 years of protection, friendship, and idol worship lost in a single night. Tossed away as easily as I tossed the crumpled note at the plastic trash can against the wall. When it misses and bounces onto the floor, I crawl over, pick it up, drop it in. Then I pick up the trash can and fling it across the room. After it slams into the wall and drops straight down, I grab something else, the remote. This too goes flying, breaking apart against the bed's headboard. I lunge for the tangled sheets drooping onto the floor, tearing at them, twisting them around my bald fists, holding them to my mouth to muffle my sobs. Coop's gone. I'd always assumed this day would come at some point. Hell, it had almost already happened, right before that threatening letter pulled him back into my orbit. But I'm not prepared for a life in which Coop isn't there when I need him. I'm not sure I can handle things on my own. But now I have no choice. Now there's no one left in my life but Jeff. Jeff. Fuck. Knowing how much I've betrayed him sends a wave of nausea pushing into my gut, jabbing me. This will devastate him. I decide on the spot to never, ever tell him what I've done. It's my only option. I'll find a way to forget about this musty room, these tangled sheets, the feeling of Coop's chest against my breasts, his breath hot in my ear. Like Pine Cottage, I'll block it all from my memory. And when I face Jeff again, he won't suspect a thing. He'll see only the Quincy he thinks he knows. The normal Quincy. Plan in place, I sit up, trying to ignore the guilt squeezing my insides. It's a feeling I'll need to get used to. I check my phone and see 3 missed calls and 1 missed text from Jeff. I can't listen to his messages. The sound of his voice will break me. But I read his text, every word of it weighted with worry. Why aren't you answering your phone? Everything okay? I text him back. Sorry, fell asleep as soon as I got home. We'll call you later. I tack on an I love you, but delete it, worried it might make him suspicious. Already, I'm starting to think like a cheater. Besides Jeff, I've missed 1 other call. It's from Jonah Thompson, received shortly after 8, roughly an hour ago. When I call back, he answers after only 1 ring. Finally, he says. Good morning to you too, I say. Jonah ignores me. I did a little digging on Samantha Boyd, aka Tina Stone. I think you'll be very interested to see what I came up with.
What did you find?
It's hard to explain over the phone, Jonah says. You need to see it in person. I sigh. Bethesda Fountain. 20 minutes. Bring coffee.
Pine Cottage, 11:49 p.m. The moon had slipped behind some clouds, leaving the woods darker than before. Quincy had trouble staying on the path, the ground beneath her feet a dim muddle of leaves and underbrush. But she had reached the incline. She could feel the weight of extra effort tight in her calves. She had no plan, not really. She just wanted to confront them. She wanted to go to that rock, stand before their panting, moon-streaked bodies, and tell them how much she hurt. The knife would make them believe it. It would make them scared. Soon Quincy was halfway up the incline, heart pumping hot blood, breath escaping in ragged puffs. As she marched upward, she was struck with the sensation that she was being watched. It was nothing more than a tickle on the back of her neck, telling her she wasn't alone. She stopped, looked around. Although she saw nothing, she couldn't shake the feeling of eyes on her body. It made her think of the Indian ghosts rumored to roam the forest. She welcomed them, those vengeful spirits, eager to have them join her cause. A sound entered the woods, quick footsteps shush-shushing through the fallen leaves. For a moment, Quincy thought there really were ghosts in the forest, a herd of them coming toward her. She glanced behind her, expecting to see them swooping through the trees. But this ghost was all too human. Quincy heard gasps of exertion heavier than her own. Soon the sound was right behind her, making her spin. Joe appeared, awake now and hastily dressed. His sweater was on backward. The tag scraped his Adam's apple as he stared at Quincy. "I need to be alone," she said. His breath was still heavy, gasping out words.
"Don't do this."
Quincy turned away. Just looking at him made her queasy. She still felt him inside her. The burning between her legs both shamed and excited her. "You don't know what I'm going to do."
"I do," he said, "and it's not worth it."
"How do you know?"
"Because I've done it, and I felt the same way then that you do now."
"Leave me alone."
"I know you want to hurt them," he said.
The thick darkness that had enveloped Quincy suddenly vanished, leaving her dizzy and disoriented. She saw the knife in her hand and sucked in air. She couldn't remember why she had picked it up. Had she honestly intended to use it on them? On herself? Shame burned through her. She shook her head back and forth. The dark forest blurred. "It's not what you think," she said.
"Isn't it?"
"I wasn't..." She stopped talking, knowing that whatever she said wouldn't make sense. Words had failed her.
"You should go back," he said. "It's not right to be out here like this."
"They hurt me," Quincy said, suddenly crying again.
"I know,"
he said.
"That's why you should go back now."
Quincy wiped her eyes. She hated herself for crying in front of him. Hated how she had enjoyed being with him. Hated the fact that, out of everyone in that cabin, he was the only one who saw the real Quincy. "I will," she said. "Where are you going?" He stared forward, as if seeking out a location in the far distance, somewhere beyond the trees.
"Home," he said. "You should go home, too."
Quincy nodded. She dropped the knife. It landed on its side, cushioned by leaves. Then she ran back the way she came, passing him, trying to ignore the way the moonlight clouded his glasses, turning the lenses opaque, like a fog.
36. 25 minutes after hanging up with Jonah, I'm in Central Park, rushing through the Baroque tunnel that leads to Bethesda Terrace. I spot him through the ornate arches at the tunnel's end, seated at the fountain's edge. Pink shirt, blue pants, gray sport coat. Towering above him is the Angel of the Waters, a flock of pigeons resting on her outstretched wings. "Sorry I'm late," I say, sitting beside him. Jonah sniffs.
"Whoa,"
he says. I, too, can smell myself. I'd wanted to take a shower in the hotel, but there was no hot water left. I had to make do with a few well-placed splashes from the sink before putting on the clothes I've been wearing since the day before. While dressing, I thought about how many miles these clothes have traveled in the past 24 hours. From Chicago to Muncie and back again. From Chicago to New York to that Spartan closet of shame. Now they've made their way into Central Park, stinking and sweat-stained. After today, I think I'll burn them. "Walk of shame?" Jonah asks. "Save it," I say. "Where's my coffee?" Two cups sit by his feet, Beside them is a messenger bag, filled with what I hope is enough information about Sam to force her out of my life. If not, I'd settle for getting her out of my apartment. "Pick your poison," Jonah says, raising the cups. "Black or cream and sugar?"
"Cream and sugar. Preferably intravenously."
He hands me a cup marked with an X. I gulp down half of its contents before coming up for air.
"Thank you," I say.
"No matter how many good deeds you perform today, nothing will top this." "You'll be rethinking that in a minute," Jonah says as he reaches for the messenger bag.
"What did you find?"
He unzips the bag and pulls out a beige folder. "A bombshell." Inside the folder are dozens of loose pages. Jonah riffles through them, fingers nimble, allowing me only brief glimpses of photocopied news articles and files printed from the internet. "A search of Samantha Boyd turns up all the usual information about the Nightlight Inn," he says. "She's the lone survivor, a final girl. Went off the grid 8 years ago and was never seen or heard from again until a few days ago."
"I already know that," I say.
"Tina Stone is a different story." Jonah finally stops flipping through the folder, landing on a news clipping. He hands it to me. "This is from the Hazleton Eagle, 12 years ago."
My heart thumps loud in my chest when I look at the clipping. I recognize it. The same one was at Lisa's house.
"Hazleton, Pennsylvania. A man was found stabbed to death yesterday inside the home he shared with his wife and stepdaughter. Responding to emergency calls, Hazleton police found Earl Potash, 46, dead in the kitchen of his Maple Street duplex, the victim of multiple stab wounds to the chest and stomach. Authorities have ruled the incident a homicide. The investigation is continuing."
"How did you find this?"
"Through a LexisNexis search on Tina Stone," Jonah says.
"But what does this have to do with her?"
"According to the newspaper, Earl Potash's stepdaughter confessed to killing him, citing years of sexual abuse. Because sexual assault was a factor, her name was shielded in court records."
Now I know why Lisa had the article. "It was her," I say. "Tina Stone. She killed her stepfather."
Jonah gives a firm nod. "Afraid so." I gulp down more coffee, hoping it will chase away the headache that's again blooming in my skull. At that moment, I would likely kill for a Xanax.
"I still don't understand," I say. "Why would Sam change her name to be the same as a woman who murdered her stepdad?"
"That's the strange thing," Jonah says. "I'm not sure she actually did." Out of the folder come several pages of medical records. At the top is the name Tina Stone.
"Aren't medical records also supposed to be classified?" I ask.
"Clearly you've underestimated my powers," Jonah says. "Bribes are a great motivator."
"You're despicable."
I flip through the records, which begin with last year and go backward. Tina Stone went to the doctor sporadically, always in the case of an emergency, and usually without health insurance. I see a broken wrist 4 years ago, the result of a motorcycle accident. A mammogram a year earlier after she found a lump that ended up being benign. An overdose of anatrophilin 8 years ago. That one gives me pause. There's a second overdose attempt 1 page and 2 years before that. I look at the date. 3 weeks after Pine Cottage.
"This can't be Sam," I say. "The dates don't match up. She told me she didn't change her name until a few years after Pine Cottage."
The realization, when it comes, almost sends me reeling backward into the fountain. I drop the folder, its pages scattering, forcing Jonah to scramble for them before they can blow away. I remain motionless when he returns to my side, folder tucked under his arm. "You get it now, right?"
"Tina Stone and Samantha Boyd," I say. "They're not the same person."
"Which begs the question, which one is in your apartment?"
I have no idea. But I need to find out. Immediately. I stand, legs wobbly, prepared to leave. Jonah stops me, an apologetic look pinching his face as he says, "Unfortunately, there's more." He opens the folder, flips to a page in the back. "There's an incident where she OD'd." "I know," I say. "It's from before the alleged name change. You might want to look at where she overdosed." Jonah points to the name of the facility where Tina Stone was treated. Blackthorn Psychiatric Hospital, located just on the other side of the woods from Pine Cottage. Looking at it makes me instantly woozy. Worse than when I woke up that morning. Almost worse than the moment I realized I had beaten Ricardo Ruiz to within an inch of his life. Tina Stone was a patient at Blackthorn. The same time he was. The exact same time he went to Pine Cottage and gutted my world.
Pine Cottage, midnight. The first scream arrived when Quincy reached the cabin's back deck. It blasted from the forest, swooping toward her as she climbed the stubby wooden steps. Quincy turned toward the sound, too surprised to feel afraid. The fear would come later. She scanned the dark forest behind the cabin, whipping her gaze from tree to tree, as if the scream had come from one of them. But she already knew its source. Janelle. Quincy was certain. A second scream erupted from the woods. Longer than the first, it became a crackle of noise stretching across the sky. It was also louder. Loud enough to spook an owl from the upper branches of a nearby tree. The bird skated past the deck, wings thumping, vanishing over the cabin roof. The sound of its retreat blended with the approach of something else. Footsteps, reckless ones. A moment later, Craig burst out of the woods. His eyes were blank, but there was a crazed jerkiness to his movements. His shirt was back on, so were his pants, although Quincy noticed how the fly was undone and that his unbuckled belt jangled and flapped.
"Run, Quincy!" he stumbled forward, frantic. "We gotta run!"
He was on the deck by then, making an attempt to drag her along as he streaked past her. Quincy's arm went limp in his hands. She wasn't going anywhere, not until Janelle was with them.
"Janelle!"
she shouted. Her voice echoed, bouncing through the woods, creating new calls, each one more faint than the last. They were answered with another scream. Craig yelped when he heard it. He did a little shimmy, as if trying to shake something from his back.
"Come on!"
he shouted at Quincy. But a fourth scream lured her forward to the deck's top step, the toes of her shoes peeking over the edge. Behind her, Craig tried to get inside, blocked by the others pushing their way out.
"What was that?"
asked Amy, fear slashing her voice.
"Where's Janelle?"
asked Betts.
"Dead,"
Craig yelled.
"She's dead."
But she wasn't. Quincy still heard her choked breaths hissing in the night. Footfalls as quiet as cat's paws stumbled through the woods. Janelle appeared suddenly, materializing like one of her Indian ghosts along the tree line behind the cabin. She didn't stand so much as hover, only the instinct of standing keeping her upright. Dark blooms of red dotted her dress at her shoulder, chest, stomach. Both hands were at her neck, one clamped tightly over the other. Blood streamed from beneath her palms, a crimson waterfall running down her chest. That's when the fear struck. A gut-tightening, body-stilling fear that left the others motionless at the back door. Only Quincy managed to move, the fear pushing her forward, off the deck, into grass just starting to gather frost. It crunched under her feet as she moved to Janelle. Cold wetness seeped into her shoes. Then she was at Janelle, reaching out, catching her as she drooped forward. Janelle's hands fell away from her neck, exposing the wide slash across it. Blood poured from the wound, hot and sticky, all over Quincy's white dress. Quincy covered the gash with her hands. The pumping blood tickled her palms. Then Janelle's body went slack, the weight shifting onto Quincy, making her twist onto her knees. Soon she was seated on the ground, Janelle a rag doll in her lap, staring at her with wide, terror-struck eyes as her breath rattled.
"Help!"
Quincy screamed, even though she already knew Janelle was beyond help.
"Help! Please!"
The others remained on the deck. Amy curled against Rodney, the hem of her nightgown flapping. Betts began to sob uncontrollably, the sound rising and falling. Only Craig looked at them. Quincy felt like he could see into her very heart, like he knew every one of her awful, awful secrets. She stared at him, seeing a new rush of fear in his eyes.
"Quincy, run!"
But Quincy couldn't, not with Janelle still dying in her arms, not even when she felt a new presence in their midst, something vile, seething hate. He was upon them before she could turn around to look, fingers dug into her hair, collecting a handful, yanking hard. Pain shimmered through her as she was whipped around, seeing what the others saw. A figure looming, a knife charging, a silvery flash. The stabs arrived almost simultaneously, one right after the other. Two sharp strikes of pain in her shoulder, hot ones, searing through skin and muscle, nicking bone. Quincy didn't scream. It hurt too much. The pain screamed through her instead. She slumped over, Janelle rolling from her lap. They lay together on the ground, face to face, Quincy staring into Janelle's dead eyes. Blood pooled in the grass between them, melting the frost, steaming slightly. He was still there. Quincy heard the even rhythm of his breathing. A hand touched her hair again, not pulling, caressing. "There, there," he said. Quincy saw him on the far edge of her vision, still a shadow, and as she waited for that final bite of the knife, he began to move, past her, past what had once been Janelle, on his way back to Pine Cottage. It was the last thing Quincy saw before pain and grief and fear overwhelmed her. Black clouds rolled across her vision, blurring the world. She closed her eyes, welcoming oblivion, letting the darkness take over.
37. Jonah begs me to let him come back to the apartment with me, but I won't allow it. He says it's too dangerous, and he's right. Yet his presence would only complicate things. This needs to be between me and Sam. Or Tina. Or whoever the fuck she is. Once again, I practice caution when entering the apartment. And once again, I wish that she isn't there. But she is. In the foyer, I hear the steady flow of water coming from the hallway bathroom. Sam is in the shower. I go to the bathroom door and hover there until I hear noises from the other side. A cough from Sam. A clearing of her cigarette-agitated throat. The shower continues to flow. I hurry into Sam's room, where her knapsack still leans in the corner. I can't open it. My hands are shaking too much. I take some deep breaths, aching for a Xanax despite knowing I need a clear head. Yet addiction wins out, pulling me into the kitchen long enough to pop a single Xanax into my mouth. I then take several gulps of grape soda, continuing to drink long after the pill has slipped down my throat. Properly fortified, it's back to Sam's room. My hands are steadier now, and the knapsack opens with ease. I root through it, pulling out stolen clothes, black t-shirts, an array of worn bras and panties. A bottle of wild turkey emerges, a fresh one still unopened. It clunks to the floor and rolls against my knees. Inside the knapsack, I swat against items that have slid to the bottom, a brush, deodorant, an empty pill bottle. I check the label. Ambien, not anatrophilin. I find the iPhone Sam took from my secret drawer. The same phone I had stolen from the cafe. It's turned off, the battery likely dead. At the very bottom of the knapsack, my fingertips skim across a cool slick of glossy pages. A magazine. I yank it out, flipping it over to look at the cover. It's a copy of Time, dog-eared and threatening to rip from its stapled binding. The photo on the front shows a ramshackle motel surrounded by cop cars and scrub pines dripping with Spanish moss. The headline, in red letters slammed over a slate-gray sky, reads, Hotel Horror. It's the same issue of Time I devoured as a child, shuddering beneath my covers, dreading the nightmares to come. I riffle through the pages until I find the article that prompted so much childhood fear. It features another picture of the Nightlight Inn, an exterior shot of one of its rooms. In the open doorway, there's a flash of white, one of the victims covered with a sheet. The article begins next to it in a narrow column of text. You think it only happens in the movies. That it couldn't happen in real life. At least, not like that. And certainly not to you. But it happened. First at a sorority house in Indiana. Then at a motel in Florida. The passage has the ring of something familiar. A kiss of deja vu. Not from my childhood, although I had certainly read it back then. This memory is more recent. Sam said it to me during her first night here. The huddled girl talk, the wild turkey passed between us. Her sincere soliloquy about the Nightlight Inn. It was a load of bullshit, lifted word for word from this magazine. I stuff her belongings back into the knapsack. Everything but the magazine, which I can use as ammunition against her, and the stolen iPhone, which can be used against me. The magazine is rolled under my arm. I shove the phone down the front of my shirt, securing it beneath a bra strap. Satisfied I'm leaving the room in almost the same condition as when I entered, I hurry back to the kitchen and grab the grape soda, carrying it with me to my laptop. I take another sip as I crack open the computer and click my way to YouTube. In the search field, I type Samantha Boyd interview. It yields several versions of Sam's Soul TV interview, all of them uploaded by the same freaks who run murder porn websites. I click on the first one, and the video begins. On screen is the same TV newswoman who had slipped the Chanel-scented interview offer under my door. Her expression is benign, a mask of impartiality. Only her eyes betray her. They're black and ravenous. The eyes of a shark. A young woman sits with her back facing the camera, barely in the frame. What can be seen of her is in silhouette. She's a half-girl, blurred beyond recognition. "Do you remember what happened to you that night, Samantha?" the newswoman asks. "Sure, I remember." That voice. It doesn't sound like the Sam I know. Interview Sam's voice isn't as clear, the diction less precise. "Do you think about it often?" "A lot," interview Sam replies. "I think about him all the time." "You're referring to Calvin Whitmer, right? The sack man?" There's a tilt of darkness as interview Sam nods and says, "I can still see him, you know, when I close my eyes. He had cut eye holes into the sack.
plus a little slit right over his nose for air. I'll never forget the way it flapped when he breathed. He had tied string around his neck to keep the sack in place. She stole that line, too, saying it to me as if for the first time. I go back to the start of the video, slightly dizzy as Miss Chanel No. 5 trains her shark eyes on Interview Sam. Do you remember what happened to you that night, Samantha? I blink, my eyes suddenly tired. Sure, I remember. The voices on the computer become distant and vague. Do you think about it often? Numbness creeps into my body. Hands first, then up my arms like a line of fire ants. A lot. I think about him all the time. The laptop screen goes fuzzy, the interviewer's face lurching out of focus. When I look away, I see the entire kitchen has turned into blurred streaks of color. I glance at the grape soda, which has brightened into a Wonka-esque neon purple. My hands are too numb to lift the bottle, so I bump it with an elbow, its dregs fizzing. Swirling along the bottom are powdery bits of Xanax that glow blue. A voice rises behind me. I knew you'd be thirsty. I spin myself around to see her in the kitchen, dressed and dry. The shower still runs in the distance, as muffled as Interview Sam's voice trickling from the laptop. It was a decoy. A trap. What? I can't speak. My tongue has thickened, feeling like a fish flopping in my mouth. Shh, she says. She's turned into a shadowy blur, just like her counterpart still talking on my laptop. Interview Sam come to life. Only she isn't Sam. Even the pills wreaking havoc on my nervous system can't suppress that. It's a moment of clarity. My last one for God knows how long. Maybe forever. Tina, I say, fat tongue still flip-flopping. Tina Stone. She makes a move toward me. I react by reaching for the woodblock knife holder on the counter, my arm moving in slow motion. I grab the biggest knife. In my hand, it weighs 100 pounds. I stumble forward, legs useless, feet as heavy as rocks. I manage one weak jab before the knife drops from my limp noodle fingers. The kitchen tilts. Only I know it's really me who's doing the tilting. Falling sideways, everything a sickening blur as my skull smashes against the floor.
1 year after Pine Cottage. Tina was among the last to go. She sat on her squeaky bed, staring blankly at the one on the other side of the room, most recently occupied by a stringy-haired pyromaniac named Heather. It had been stripped of sheets, leaving only a lumpy mattress with an oblong urine stain. On the wall beside it, not quite hidden under a coat of paint, were the curse words scrawled in lipstick by Heather's predecessor, May. When she got transferred, she bequeathed her stash of lipstick to Tina. All told, Tina had spent more than 3 years in that room, the longest time she had spent in any one place. Not that she had a choice. The state decided that for her. But now it was time to go. Nurse Hattie shouted it from the hallway in that grating hick accent of hers. Closing time, folks. Everybody out. Tina lifted the knapsack that leaned against her bed. It used to be Joe's. His parents left it behind when they cleaned out his room after he was killed. Now it was hers, and everything she owned was inside, which wasn't much. Its lightness astonished her. As Tina left the room, she didn't look back. She had moved around enough to know that long last looks didn't make leaving any easier, even if you had been dying to leave since the moment you arrived. In the hallway, Tina took her place with the other stragglers, lining up for one last head count. Instead of seeing that everyone was there, the orderlies were making sure no one stayed behind. At noon, Blackthorne's doors were closing for good. The majority of Blackthorne's patients were still too crazy to be let loose upon the world. They had already been transferred to other state facilities, Heather among them. Tina was one of the few deemed mentally fit to be released. She had served her time. Now she was free to go. After headcount, she and the others were shuffled through the wide and drafty rec room, which was already being cleared of furniture. Tina saw that the TV had been dismantled from the wall and that most of the chairs had been stacked in a corner. But her table was still there, the table beside the grated window where she and Joe would sit and peer out at the woods on the other side of Blackthorne's scrubby patch of lawn, naming all the places they would go once they got out. Tina did allow one last look at that, instantly regretting it, for it made her think about Joe. She had been ordered not to think about him. Yet she did, all the time. Leaving wouldn't change that. She had also been ordered not to think about that night, about the terrible things that happened, all those dead kids. But how could she not? It was the reason the place was closing, the very reason she and the others were being marched out. Some of the orderlies came by to watch them leave. Matt Cromley was there, that perm-headed prick. He had put his hand down Tina's pants so many times she lost count. She glared at him as she passed. He gave her a wink and licked his lips. Parked outside was a van that would take them to the bus station. After that, no one gave a damn where they went, as long as it wasn't there. As Tina climbed aboard, Nurse Hattie handed her a large envelope. Inside was the name of a social services agency that would help her find employment, her medical records, all necessary prescriptions, and cash that Tina knew would last only about a measly 2 weeks. Nurse Hattie put a hand on her shoulder and smiled. "Have a great life, Tina. Go make something of yourself." 2 years after Pine Cottage. There was no one home. Tina kept telling herself that as she knocked again on the sun-bleached door. There was no one home, and she should just leave. But she couldn't leave. She was down to her last dollar. Tina tried to make a go of it, and for a while she had. Thanks to that nice lady at social services, she had a job, even though it was bagging groceries at a gritty-floored supermarket, and a place to live at a boarding house built for people like her. But all those health code violations killed the store, which meant she couldn't pay for the boarding house. Those unemployment checks barely covered food and bus fare. So now she was back in Hazleton, still knocking on the door of a duplex she hadn't seen in 4 years, praying no one would answer it. When someone did, she almost ran away. She'd rather die of starvation than be there. But she willed her legs to remain on that worn welcome mat. The woman who opened the door was fatter than when Tina last saw her, an ass as wide as a love seat. She held a baby on her hip, a writhing, crying, red-faced little shit in a drooping diaper. Tina took one look at it, and her heart sank. Another kid. That poor, doomed thing. "Hi, Mama," Tina said. "I'm home." Her mother looked at her as if she were a stranger. She sucked in her fat cheeks, lips puckering. "This ain't your home," she said. "You made sure of that." Tina's heart seized up, even though this was exactly what she had expected. Her mother never believed that Earl did those things to her. The touching and the fondling and the sliding under her covers at 3 in the morning. "Shh," he'd say, with beer stench on his breath. Don't tell your mama.
Please, mama, Tina said. I need help.
The baby fussed even more. Tina wondered if the kid had been told about his half-sister. She wondered if she'd ever been mentioned. A man's voice cut through the cries, coming from the living room. Tina had no idea who he was.
Who's at the door?
Tina's mother stared at her. No one important. 3 years after Pine Cottage. The bar was packed for a Tuesday night. All the stools were filled, tables too. Nothing like $2 beers to bring in the barely functioning alcoholics. The crowd kept Tina hopping her entire shift as heaps of empty mugs and ketchup-smeared plates came her way. She washed them all, her hands submerged in the water so long her fingers had become shriveled and bleached. When her shift was over, she whipped off her hairnet and shucked her apron, stuffing them into the laundry bin by the kitchen's back door. She then headed into the bar itself, claiming the employee-eligible free drink that was supposed to make up for how the owner skimped on wages. Lyle was tending bar that night. Tina liked him more than the others. He had a handlebar mustache, a sexy overbite, and thick, hairy forearms. He poured her drink without even asking what she wanted.
"And a wild turkey for Miss Tina," he said, also pouring one for himself.
They clinked glasses. "Cheers," Tina said, before downing the whiskey in a single gulp. She ordered another. Lyle gave it to her for free, even though she told him she had enough cash to pay for it. She sipped this one, sitting at the far end of the bar, people watching. The crowd was a nondescript blur, an interchangeable display of big hair, beer guts, and gin blossoms. Tina vaguely recognized most of them. Then she saw someone she truly did recognize. He was slid into a back booth and getting grabby with a redhead who clearly didn't want to be grabbed. It had been a few years, but he looked exactly the same. Not even his laughable man perm had changed. Matt Cromley. The orderly who had groped her and Heather and God knows how many other women at Blackthorn. Seeing him after all these years unlocked the box in Tina's mind where the bad memories were stored. It made her think of all the times he had yanked her into that utility closet, plunging his hand down her pants while hissing, "You're not going to tell anyone, you hear? I can make things bad for you, you know. Real bad." The only person she told was Joe. It made him so mad he offered to stab the slime ball, which is what had landed him at Blackthorn in the first place. Some community college shithead had kept bullying him. Joe fought back by driving a steak knife into his side. Tina declined the offer. Only now she wished she had taken him up on it. Pricks like Matt Cromley shouldn't be allowed to go unpunished. That's why Tina downed her drink. She slipped into the kitchen for a few supplies. Then she sidled up to his booth, gave him a siren smile, and said, "Hey, stranger." 10 minutes later, they were standing in a patch of weeds behind the bar. One of Matt's hands already snaked down the front of her jeans, the other furiously stroking that minuscule prick of his.
"You like that, don't you?" he groaned. "Like the way Matty Boy makes you feel?"
Tina nodded, although in truth his touch made her want to puke. But she endured it. She knew it wouldn't last long.
"How many girls did you do this to?" she said, "back at Blackthorn." "I don't know."
He was practically panting, his voice rough in her ears.
10, or 11, or 12.
Tina's body went rigid. "This is for them." She shoved an elbow into his stomach, which made him double over and back away, taking his cold, slimy hand with him. She then whirled around and punched him, repeatedly, quick, sharp jabs right to his nose. Soon he was on his knees, holding his hands to his nose to try to halt the blood spurting out of it. Tina kicked him in the stomach, in his ribs, in his groin. Once he was flat on his back and rolling in pain, Tina shoved a dish rag from the kitchen into his mouth. She yanked off his jeans and underwear. She tore at his shirt, ripping the seams until it was nothing but shreds stuck to his shoulders. Then she tied rope she had found under the kitchen sink around his wrists and ankles. Once he was good and secure, Tina whipped out the black dry erase marker swiped from the whiteboard that listed the daily drink specials. Cap between her teeth, she jerked the marker open and scrawled three words across Matt Cromley's naked torso. Molester. Pervert. Scum. She took his clothes with her when she left. 9 years after Pine Cottage. It was October, which meant she was thinking about Joe. It always happened when fall rolled around. Even 9 years later, that crisp chill in the air took her mind back to him in his sand-colored sweater, sneaking down the hall. "Wait for me," she had whispered frantically at the back door, trying to catch up to him. Each year, she thought it would be different, that the memories would fade. But now, though, she suspected they were a permanent part of her, just like the tattoo on her wrist. During her smoke break behind the diner, Tina rubbed her thumb across the tattoo, feeling the dark smoothness of the letters. Survivor. It had been 6 years since she got it. Long before she'd found her way north to Bangor. She got it in a fit of inspiration after writing all over Matt Cromley's pink and pudgy body. She didn't regret it one bit. It made her feel strong, even though she later worried that some customers would be put off by it and tip her less. Instead, most folks gave her more. The pity tippers. Thanks to them, she had been able to buy a car. It was nothing but a third-hand Ford Escort, but she didn't care. Wheels were wheels. Inside the diner, the lunch crowd was starting to trickle in. Tina recognized the majority of the customers. She'd been around long enough to know who they were and what they wanted. Only one customer was a stranger, a goth kid draped in black. The way he kept staring at her creeped her out. When she went to take his order, she said, "Do I know you?" The kid looked up at her. "No, but I know you." "I don't think so." "You're that girl," he said, eyes locked on her tattoo. "That girl who almost got herself killed at that hotel all those years back." Tina snapped her gum. "I don't know what you're talking about. Your secret's safe with me." The kid lowered his voice to a whisper. "I won't tell anyone you're Samantha Boyd." When her shift was through, Tina went straight to the library and its bank of outdated computers. Sitting among the elderly and internet-deprived, she Googled the name Samantha Boyd. They didn't look so alike that they could be mistaken for twins. She was a bit thinner than Samantha, and their eyes weren't quite the same. But the resemblance was there. It could be even stronger if Tina made her hair as dark as that goth kid's. She thought of Joe again. It couldn't be helped. A search of his name brought up the same picture that had been printed everywhere after the Pine Cottage murders. And wherever Joe's picture appeared, one of that girl always followed. Quincy Carpenter, the survivor. Tina stared at Quincy's picture, then at Joe's, then back to Samantha Boyd, her dark-haired doppelganger. In the back of her brain, something clicked. A plan. 9 years and 11 months after Pine Cottage. Tina hauled her knapsack from the